Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. 820 million people go hungry around the world every day. Many of those people are small farmers who have been adversely impacted by a global food system that promotes multinational agribusinesses like Monsanto. In his new book, Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food, today's guest, Timothy Weiss, traveled to several countries around the world, including Mexico and India. He also went to the state of Iowa to learn more about how food is grown, to learn more about the influence of corporate agribusinesses, the global expansion of genetically modified seed markets, and international trade agreements shaping food policies. He writes, quote, "Agribusiness companies have such a powerful hold in the United States that they have convinced policymakers and the general public, and even many farmers, that their interests are completely aligned with those of farmers," end quote. So what did Tim Weiss find, and what are alternatives to these big agribusiness models? Timothy Weiss is a senior researcher at the Small Planet Institute and senior research fellow at Tufts University's Global Development and Environment Institute. His new book is Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thanks for your important book. Before we dive in, I want to talk with you about the UN report that's getting international headlines today. It is connected to what you write about, and I'm just reading here from The Guardian. Human society under urgent threat from loss of Earth's natural life. Human society is in jeopardy from the accelerating decline of the Earth's natural life support systems, the world's leading scientists have warned as they announce the results of the most thorough planetary health check ever undertaken, from the coral reefs to oceans, to rainforests. Nature is being destroyed at a rate tens to hundreds of times higher than the average over the past 10 million years. This is according to a UN Global Assessment report. Tim, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time on the show, but the reports just continue to come out with dire warnings that we need to take action sooner than later.
Yeah, no, I mean, I haven't had a chance to digest the whole report yet, but it's certainly a yet another urgent warning that, as I say in the book, if we don't change directions, we're going to get where we're going, and we don't want to get there.
Well, we'll put a link to this on our website, yourcallradio.org, and we will definitely do a show about this in the coming weeks. Your book, Tim, is very extensive. You travel to Iowa, Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia, Mexico, and the Indian state of Madhya Pradesh. And you focus on years of global dominance by these big ag companies and how big donors and governments are in many ways responsible for what's happening to local and sustainable farming. Why did you decide to write this book and travel to these particular places to get answers to these questions?
Well, I've been working in this field for 30 years in agricultural development in a variety of different ways, and the thing that was most striking to me about the price spike that we all saw in food prices about 10 years ago were that they seemed to be a wake-up call. They certainly changed the narrative about how about the role of small-scale farmers in feeding their communities and feeding their countries and feeding the world. We saw prices double or triple in international markets. We saw food riots in many parts of the world. We saw governments suddenly saying that they should grow more of their own food rather than import it. And that portended well for reversing long-term trends that had really discriminated against small-scale farmers and small-scale food producers in particular in developing countries. And I was disturbed to see that 5 years beyond that, that food price crisis, policies were very much the same. So I really wanted to find out why policymakers in developing countries in particular were so blind to the low-cost solutions to hunger and food insecurity and climate change that were all around them, offered by their own small-scale farmers. And partly what I found was that agribusiness companies and their philanthropic and government backers have largely hijacked the policy process in their favor in most countries.
As you write, agribusiness companies have such a powerful hold in the United States that they've convinced policymakers and the public that their interests are completely aligned with those farmers. And it's not just the United States, as you show in your book.
Right. I was struck in my research in Southern Africa and somewhat surprised that I found such direct involvement and advocacy and lobbying and policy influence from some of the major multinational agribusiness firms that we know from the United States. A lot of them were everywhere.
So let's step back a minute. Since you brought up the food crisis, can you remind us what caused the food crisis in 2008?
Well, there's a lot of debate about what actually caused it. It was a confluence of things. But what I have a chapter in the book on the biofuels expansion in the United States. And I think that was probably the most significant cause, because what it did was through government policies that mandated and provided incentives for the use of corn to make ethanol for our cars. The mandate included the mandated inclusion of ethanol as 10% of the gasoline mixture, and that dramatically increased the demand for corn in a very short period of time. And that diversion of a food crop and feed crop into the fuel markets and out of those markets created price surges, as there were shortages and perceived shortages, and it diverted land as farmers saw corn prices go through the roof and shifted their land out of other crops, creating again short-term shortages in other crops. And so I think it's fair to say that a toxic mix of U.S. biofuels policy and then the financial crisis, with financial speculation in particular on commodity markets, accelerating the volatility of those prices.
Over the course of the hour, Tim, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about agribusinesses and big ag. And I notice that in conversations about these issues, unlike oil companies, you've got, you know, environmental activists and organizations naming the names BP, Exxon, Shell. I mean, we can all list at least five of them. But when we're talking about big ag, Monsanto gets attention and DuPont, but especially the meat companies, they're not really named in the conversations. And so I just want to point out, as you write in your book, at a global scale and in many African countries, the dominant agribusiness players are household names: Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, John Deere. And then you've got Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, Tyson, Smithfield, Nestle, and Kellogg's. So I think it's important to name these because they're not named as often as oil and gas companies.
Right. I think that's true, although you'd be surprised, depending on where you are in the country, how well known those names are, because they are, for farmers in Iowa, the main buyers of their crops are often Cargill. The main final consumers of their crops, because they run the meat companies, Smithfield and Tyson, ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, because it is one of the largest ethanol refiners in the country. So depending on where you are, these companies can be very well known. Again, I was surprised to see how many of them were on the ground players in developing countries as well.
You write that in many cases, the revenue of these companies exceeds the gross domestic products of the countries in which they operate. I mean, their profits are that big.
Yeah. Monsanto's revenues, this was before it was taken over by Bayer in a recent merger that further consolidated the seed and chemical industry. Their revenues were higher, larger than the gross domestic product of Malawi, where I was encountering the company in policy discussions.
So we will talk about specifics, but one of your main arguments is that these agribusinesses run the show. You write, agribusinesses mostly do not farm, but they make a great deal of money off of agriculture. They produce inputs like fertilizer, seeds, pesticides, and tractors. And so we'll talk specifically about what you found on your travels, but one of your main arguments is that they are taking part in, you know, huge relationships with government, and at the end of the day, what they're doing is not supporting small family farmers.
That's right. I mean, I think they would certainly argue that they are supporting small family farmers. In a place like Malawi, they would argue that they're providing better corn seeds for family farmers to use through an input subsidy program, a government program that is subsidizing farmers to purchase commercial seeds like Monsanto's and fertilizers. My research suggested that those programs were not benefiting farmers. Even when they were growing more corn, it wasn't benefiting them directly. And so the main beneficiaries of these government programs end up being the firms whose sales are pretty much directly subsidized by the government.
Your chapter on Malawi just says a lot about just how we got here and what people are facing on the ground. You write that you first visited the small landlocked country of Malawi in southeastern Africa in late 2014, and it was hard to believe its people often go hungry. The rainy season was well underway, and in the central region around the capital city, the landscape was lush and green. Nearly every inch of unpaved space seemed to be planted in corn. So tell us more about that.
Malawi is a remarkable country. It's a small landlocked country in southern Africa that got some notoriety because it won the moniker of the Malawi Miracle, and that was because it had endured many famines and food shortages. And it decided in 2005 to stop following the advice of the World Bank and the IMF and to start one of these input subsidy programs with its own funds. And it started subsidizing the purchase of small-scale farmers using commercial seeds and fertilizers. And it seemed to work. It seemed to increase, in the short run, at least the production of corn, which is the country's main staple. Malawi became known as the Malawi Miracle. When I got there, that miracle was starting to unravel. But it was certainly striking what an agricultural country Malawi is, and how that agriculture is overwhelmingly dominated by small-scale farmers on 2 to 4 acres of land, growing staple crops like corn for their own consumption and for sale in the marketplace. It looked like a beautifully lush and agriculturally productive country.
And take us back, Tim, and just explain how this process works, because you write that the World Food program has had permanent offices in Malawi, and for good reason. Yet another crop shortfall in 2005, the government took a stand rejecting World Bank and IMF advice by launching broad-based government subsidies for the country's small-scale farmers to buy seeds and fertilizers, and it worked. I mean, how common is it, and what does it take for a government to reject World Bank and IMF advice?
It's a dramatic step, and the poorer you are, and the more dependent you are as a government on donor funds, the more courage it takes to take that step. And I do give the Malawian government a lot of credit for taking that step. What the problem is that the step they took turned out to be the wrong one. Subsidizing the purchase of commercial seeds and imported fertilizers, because they really aren't working the way they are sold as working, and they're really not an affordable solution for Malawi's poor small-scale farmers. They aren't getting good enough returns on putting these new inputs into their land that for them to expand and to continue purchasing those inputs on their own. So it's proving to be a failed strategy, and that's what I saw all over in the countries in Africa that I studied. This the so-called Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, the Green Revolution referring to the 1960s and 70s use of seeds and fertilizer to increase production in Asia and parts of Latin America. That strategy is really falling short. Both from a food security perspective, it's really not increasing food security for the most vulnerable people in Africa, and it's not addressing the long-term productivity of agriculture, which is really related to the improving the quality of the soil. These inputs actually diminish the quality of the soil if they're just grown in monocultures of corn doused with chemical fertilizers.
Today we are speaking with Timothy Weiss, senior researcher at the Small Planet Institute and senior research fellow at Tufts University's Global Development and Environment Institute. His new book is Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. And if you have any questions for Tim about the global food supply, and where we're at right now, as he reports, hundreds of millions of small-scale farmers grow 70% of the food eaten in developing countries, but agribusiness monopolies are being aggressively promoted to the detriment of farmers, the environment, and food security. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And also, if you have questions just about how all of this works, Tim has gone to a number of these conferences where these executives show up and do their bidding. And so he writes about what happens behind the scenes. So if you have any questions about the role of the government and then, you know, groups like the World Bank, the International Monetary Foundation, the IMF, and just how they operate in conjunction with Big Ag and how that affects the food supply, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Tim, it was interesting to learn that, like most of Africa, Malawi still does not allow genetically modified corn to be grown in the country. And so as you report, Monsanto's market is overwhelmingly hybrid corn, patented but developed through conventional breeding methods. And you met a number of farmers to talk about the hybrid maize and how it's doing. So Monsanto had about 50% of the Malawian market for the hybrid corn seeds. What did you find?
Well, the market in many countries still restrict the use of the planting of genetically modified seeds, and most of Africa falls in that category. Malawi still falls in that category, but Monsanto is you know, is sort of notorious in the United States for its aggressive promotion of genetically modified crops, it is still, apart from that, one of the largest seed companies in the world. And its market in Southern Africa has largely been corn seed. And that's true in Malawi. What the farmers there will tell you is that hybrid corn, this particular kind of commercial corn, has one advantage, which is that if you use the right inputs, like enough fertilizer, the yield can be quite a bit higher than the seeds that farmers are using saved from year to year on their farm from the last harvest. But the downside is that if you don't have those inputs, the corn doesn't really do all that well. And you have to buy the corn seed every year, because one of the great disadvantages for farmers of hybrid corn is that it will not, if you save seeds from year to year, it won't stay highly productive. The yields won't stay high. That, of course, is one of the great advantages for Monsanto and other seed sellers, because why would you want a market where you could sell seeds to a farmer and then have them save those seeds for years and years? You wouldn't sell them any more seeds if that was true. So having seeds that have to be bought every year to stay productive is a brilliant innovation by agribusiness for agribusiness.
Well, we have a caller. Let's take our caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Jason in San Francisco. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about why there's so much focus on corn in Malawi when there are native alternatives that have much like higher protein, such as millet and sorghum, and that are also much less susceptible to drought and overwatering than corn. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a really good observation and a very good question. The corn actually has a long colonial history in Southern Africa and parts of Eastern Africa that have made it the main staple crop. That's not a recent phenomenon. And in that process, it has indeed displaced much more drought tolerant, nutritious crops like pearl millet and sorghum and other crops. But the recent push, I mean, one of the distressing trends from the recent push by the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa is that they're focused on a small set of crops that Western companies know how to grow high yield seeds for. So corn becomes a focus, and then these input subsidy programs emphasize that focus. You don't get a subsidy to grow sorghum. You don't get sorghum seeds from these subsidies. You get corn seeds. And so it's prompted a greater concentration and dependence on that one crop. And like the caller says, it's not a smart choice. Corn is very water intensive, and we're talking about a region that's being heavily impacted by climate change. Droughts are more common. Very high temperatures are being recorded now, and that doesn't do corn much good either. And then the quality of the food that comes back from it is also not as nutritious for the communities. So it's a very good question, and one of the I was actually encouraged to see that everyone, including the donor agencies like the U.S. government, see the over-concentration on single crops like corn as a problem, that many are trying to figure out how to promote crop diversity and certainly, if not on an individual farm, across the across the region, a greater diversity of crops being grown in those communities.
Well, thank you for calling in, Jason. Today we are joined by Timothy Weiss. He's out with a new book, Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Tim is a senior researcher at the Small Planet Institute and senior research fellow at Tufts University's Global Development and Environment Institute. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Every Monday is our One Planet series where we talk about a wide range of environmental issues, and you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Next Monday, on a related topic, we will be talking about seeds. Today, we are speaking with Timothy Weiss about his new book, Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Timothy traveled to several countries around the world, including Mexico and India. He also went to the state of Iowa to learn more about how food is grown, about the influence of corporate agribusiness, the global expansion of genetically modified seed markets, and international trade agreements and how they're shaping food policies. If you have any questions or comments for Timothy Weiss, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. I am in the business of making textiles using U.S. certified organic cotton. We've been working with a co-op around Lubbock, Texas, 34 families farming over 20,000 acres successfully and rejecting Monsanto and fighting Monsanto every step of the way. Initially, they went into this type of agriculture because there was a high incidence of cancer in the area where they were farming. And so I understand your focus on corn, and I'm sure you could fill us in on cotton being as miserably farmed. And speaking, the last issue that I wanted to mention was in India, which is one of the largest cotton growers in the world. Thousands, as you know, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of farmers have committed suicide because the inputs simply don't work. And I think it's Vandana Shiva who suggests strongly that the real play here is to take over the land for cheap because people give up. You know, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you so much for your looking into this. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in, Mark. Tim?
Yeah, no, that's a very... that's an encouraging story that you're making a run with the a go of it with organic cotton and textiles. I think India really does point both point is a warning sign to all those who think that genetically modified cotton is going to be a savior from pests, which was what was promised. And I think it's also a positive example because there are so many initiatives underway in India right now to wean themselves from dependence on not just genetically modified crops but chemical agriculture overall. It's kind of remarkable what's going on there. Entire states, and of course states in India can be as populous as the country of Malawi, or even much, much larger, are taking the commitment to go to different kinds of either organic agriculture or low input agriculture as a way to restore their soils, stop overusing their water resources, and ultimately also restore confidence in the health of the farmer, for the farmers, and of the food that they're producing and the products they're producing.
Before we get to other calls, Tim, as you write, a number of farmers are saying no to big ag. You write that more than half of Malawi's farmers still practice some intercropping. In some regions, the practice prevails among the vast majority of farmers. I mean, you've got photos in here. You have an older woman, a Lobi farmer, displays a cob of orange maize in its meal, high in vitamin A. Another farmer in central Malawi shows off his orange maize crop. So you met a number of these farmers. Edwin Kasamba, a middle-aged farmer, posed proudly in front of his plants that looked particularly robust. Can you just talk quickly about these farmers that are saying no to big ag? Since we're talking about Malawi, we can talk about some of the people you met there.
Oh, yeah, that was a remarkable project. It's called the Malawi Farmer-to-Farmer Agroecology Project. Interesting because it began as a nutrition project. People were concerned about the dependence on corn, over-dependence on corn in the diet, and wanted to diversify diets and recognize that in farming communities, the best way to do that was to diversify the crops that were being grown. They combined that into an agroecology framework, meaning a framework in which farmers are taught how to farm with nature rather than against nature. That includes planting more than one crop in the same field, intercropping as it's called. That restores soils because it replenishes soils with a variety of different nutrients from the different crops. It also, they introduced composted manure as a substitute for chemical fertilizer. Overuse of fertilizer can result in the acidification of the soil. So it's called fertilizer, but the soil can get less fertile by its overuse or overdependence on synthetic fertilizer. So they had these remarkable set of interconnected goals and programs, but central to them in this particular community was a kind of orange corn variety that people found some farmers still growing in the region, and they recognized that it was very, very high in vitamin A and other nutrients. Vitamin A is a chronically in deficit in a lot of developing countries, including Malawi, and can cause blindness and other severe developmental problems, particularly for children. So there's always been an effort by nutritionists to try to increase the intake of vitamin A. And here was this native crop grown locally and fairly productive that people could grow. So they started promoting that as a centerpiece of this agroecology project, and it's proved tremendously successful. So successful that they're now being asked if they can grow enough to sell to aid agencies who are trying to help promote more nutritious diets and crop diversity in other communities in Malawi.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Celia in San Francisco. Hi, Celia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. So you just touched a little bit about my question in Malawi, but I wanted to know, in your experience, going to these conferences and these higher-level institutions, if there's any conversations on and the temperature around agroecology, regenerative farming, and local food sovereignty movements.
Yeah, there certainly is. I've been struck and encouraged over the course of my research for this book that that even in a place as slow to change, let's say tactfully, as the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, long time promoter of industrial scale agriculture and green revolution technologies, there's been a significant shift, some new openings for agroecology work. They have a new program that's been endorsed by the member states called Scaling Up Agroecology. This summer, they will be issuing a report by their so-called high-level panel of experts on the value of agroecology. The Secretary General has called on called business as usual in agriculture no longer an option. production, and that there is a need to shift toward more ecological farming. So I'm honestly quite encouraged by the openings that I see there. Whether they get the investments that they need is a real question. And one would hope, given the poor track record for projects like the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, that the Gates Foundation and donor governments would take a step back and say, maybe this isn't where we should be putting our money. I don't see that really happening yet. And that seems, again, like a case where agribusiness has a lot at stake in keeping those donor governments and those international agencies in supporting industrial scale agriculture and industrial scale technologies for agriculture.
Tim, we've got a number of callers on the line, and I want to make sure we get to them. But since you brought up the Gates Foundation, what can you tell us? I mean, you write about the Gates Foundation and what they're doing in many of these countries. If you had to summarize their interests and what they're spending their money on, what can you tell us on this specific issue?
I mean, well, in agriculture, they fund an astonishingly diverse array of programs, and some of them I think are laudatory. The bulk of their funding, though, is still going to programs like the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. And the problem with that is that I think it remains a somewhat blind commitment to technology and Western technology in particular as the solution to Africa's problems, in the sort of modeled on the U.S. experience. And that's just a flawed analysis. And the evidence is not really supporting that strategy. It's been going for more than 10 years, and the results do not show that it is really making a difference for food security, for rural poverty reduction, for hardly any of the stated goals that the program has. So I think the someone who knows better than I from his own interactions with the Gates Foundation, somebody who worked in the foundation world when the Gates Foundation was starting its agricultural program in 2006. And, you know, he said, well, they decided to go a direction different than the one we wanted. But frankly, you have to remember that the Gates Foundation is a family foundation with the fortunes of a technology monopolist, Bill Gates from Microsoft, and that it's probably not reasonable to expect that his solutions to global problems are going to be anything but technology-based or focused on large corporations. And I think that kind of accurately summarizes what I have seen of the Gates Foundation out in the field.
We're going to have you back to talk about what you found in other countries, but when you look at agribusiness and how they work with governments, and when you look at these foundations like the Gates Foundation, is there a big difference between what you found in, say, Mexico, India, and African countries? Or does Africa stand out in some way?
Well, Africa stands out right now because it's the new Green Revolution. So the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa is giving Africa the Green Revolution that it never had because it was left behind in the first one. And Mexico and India were the centerpieces of the first Green Revolution. So they had their Green Revolution. And so the Gates Foundation is very focused on poverty and underdevelopment. And so not surprisingly, it's focused significantly on Africa because that's where arguably that's the right place to be focused because hunger is the most severe. Farming is in some ways the least productive, and countries are still heavily dependent on agriculture for their livings.
Today we're speaking with Tim Weiss about his book, Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear next from Jackie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for taking my call. For years, I've given to Kiva, which does a lot of small loans, and many of them are good, but I've noticed their agriculture loans are all about pesticides and new good seeds, which are no doubt hybrids, and fertilizers, which are no doubt chemical. And I'm wondering, is there a group that gives loans that we can fund, help fund as a crowd to regenerative agriculture, to good agriculture that will be helpful?
That's a very good question. There are a lot of very good aid agencies working in this field that have, I think, a more long-term and holistic view of the direction that agricultural development needs to go. I've done a fair amount of, I encountered ActionAid and its work in a number of countries in Africa and elsewhere, and I think they have a good focus on what they call climate resilient smallholder agriculture, and that gives them a very good focus on working with women farmers to create a kind of regenerative agriculture that leaves them less dependent on external inputs and more resilient to climate change. That's not exactly a loan program like you're asking about, but that's the kind of that's the kind of aid that I think African governments certainly need.
I also wanted to ask you about President Obama's role in this issue. You write that in 2012, the Obama administration launched the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition. It was a multi-donor effort focused on agribusiness-led public-private partnerships. We hear about that a lot, public-private partnerships, as the vehicle for African agricultural development. Donors would provide the aid. Private companies like Monsanto, DuPont, and Cargill would make a non-binding promise to invest, and participating African governments would commit. Is this policy still in effect, and how did it impact farmers on the ground?
It was a disaster in a lot of different ways, and a really unfortunate step on the Obama administration's part. The initial response to the food price crisis that we were talking about before in 2009 was actually a significant increase in international donor support from governments for agricultural development in poor countries. We hadn't seen a significant increase in that kind of aid for many, many years. It was a three-year commitment, and 2012 came along, and Obama's response, instead of saying, well, let's double down and really build on this public investment, was to kick it to the private sector and say, basically, we're not gonna keep putting up money for this kind of thing. It's time for the private sector to take over, was almost the message. And take over they did. They used their influence and this new program to ram through a lot of policies in developing countries, like seed policies that that favored their interests. That's been the main push that I cover in the book on seeds, has been pushed by the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, by the African Regional Intellectual Property Organization, and a set of guidelines for seed policies that make it, that favor plant breeders who are commercial generally, like Monsanto, and their intellectual property over the farmers who save, exchange, and sell their own seeds. So the real tragedy of that kind of a policy I saw in Malawi as its seed policy was being debated, and those farmers who had those beautiful orange corn seeds that were so high in vitamin A, and the development agencies wanted to buy from them, the new policy implied, it still hasn't been confirmed, that they would not be able to sell those seeds. In fact, the first draft of the policy said they couldn't even call those seeds seeds because they hadn't been certified under this new Gates-backed policy. They could only be called grain, worthy of eating but not planting. And a farmer held up one kernel of his beautiful orange corn and said, how could this not be a seed? We've been growing it for generations. And indeed, that's the kind of policy change that the new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition promoted and aggressively pursued at the risk of governments losing donor support if they didn't adopt such policies.
What was the administration's reasoning for this? I mean, I'm sure they got a lot of pushback at the time, and what was their response?
I think the reasoning was we've come out of a financial crisis and we need to focus domestically. There's never been a really strong constituency in the United States advocating for international development and aid. So it was hard to fight to continue those kind of policies. And frankly, I think the Obama administration put a lot of faith and way too much faith in multinational firms to provide the kind of investment that countries truly need to move into a higher stage of development.
And how are people fighting back against this? We talked about the IMF, the World Bank, this Obama program. You also report that the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, was insistent that Malawi open its seed program to Monsanto and other transnational seed companies. How are the people fighting back against this, Tim?
Well, to finish out the new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition story, that was an interesting fight because what happened was that the companies basically didn't invest much more. The donor governments who were supposed to provide more aid just kind of reprogrammed money they'd already planned to spend, and so governments didn't get more aid. But the countries actually did change their policies. So it was a really bad deal, but the result was there was very little increase in production or productivity as a result of it. And finally, some European campaign organizations held the European government's feet to the fire on it and said, you can't continue to participate in this if you can't show any results. And it eventually has collapsed from the withdrawal of France's support for the program and then a sort of loss of interest on the part of other programs. So that kind of international campaigning can make a big difference. At the local level, there's a lot more localized resistance, and the way you can resist locally is by advocating that your government not adopt a seed policy as draconian as the one being proposed in Malawi. And indeed, farmer organizations and others actively fought against this this policy that would have declared that orange corn seed just a grain not worthy of planting. And they got some of the worst provisions taken out of that law. They now are advocating for a so-called farmers' rights bill, a law that would recognize the rights of farmers to save, exchange, and sell their seeds, among other rights that farmers should have recognized.
In your final chapter, Tim, you write that the good news is that in the battle for the future of food, farmer resistance is strong. We were just talking about that. And so are their alternatives, many advanced under the banner of food sovereignty. So you write about like Zambians fighting for a just national land policy that recognizes women's rights to secure village land and demands limits on corrupt land deals. In Mexico, farmers and their allies sustain a multi-year resistance to the forced adoption of genetically modified corn. And even in Iowa, which we're definitely going to have you back to talk about Iowa, but you write that residents there are demanding clean water from more sustainable farming practices. So there are a lot, there's so much going on the ground over the battle for the future of food.
There is. And it's more and more, I think, recognized in a lot of these countries that what's currently being done isn't working. that it's having destructive impacts. I was struck to be speaking about the book in March in Iowa, at a time when both Iowa and Mozambique, two of the countries that I write about, were underwater from devastating cyclones that had hit both places and were largely attributed to climate change. Climate change is a great equalizer and hopefully is also a wake-up call with these kind of violent storms that are devastating for farmers, particularly vulnerable farmers, because it's their land, it's their topsoil washing away, it's their land getting destroyed. And in the case of Mozambique, their crops were ripening and almost ready for harvest when they got washed away.
Well, Tim, I feel like we just scratched the surface. I mean, we didn't get to talk about India, we didn't talk about Iowa, and we did not talk about Mexico. But we would love to have you back to talk about what you found in those places and the fight for food security. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
No, thank you, and I'd love to join you again.
Great. Thank you. Tim Weiss is author of Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Tim Weiss is senior researcher at the Small Planet Institute and senior research fellow at Tufts University's Global Development and Environment Institute. And thank you so much for all of your phone calls. Every Monday, we focus on environmental issues. Over the last couple of weeks, we have talked about the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen, a list of fruits and vegetables with the highest amounts of pesticides. We talked about the future of penguins in the Antarctic. And we talked about a documentary called Lobster War, The Fight Over the World's Richest Grounds. And you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar at Your Call.